Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Psalms chapter 46, which I will entitle God is Our Fortress. The heading for that psalm given in the text is this: For the director of music of the sons of Korah, according to Alamoth, a song. Well, what is Alamoth? It's probably a musical term. It most probably denotes the treble or part sung by female voices, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. The word means virgins, and of course virgins sing with a higher pitch than men do. And this song sung by female voices was also sung with some appropriately keyed instrument, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Well, that's all speculation. That's nice. We see that the psalm is written for the sons of Korah. Of course, the sons of Korah were a choir of Levites that King David had appointed to serve in the temple worship. They were descendants of the famous Korah, who participated in and who headed Korah's famous rebellion, written about in number 16 when the earth opened up, and the Korah and his buddies fell into the crack. Well, the descendants redeemed themselves, I guess, by being a member of the temple choir, or the tabernacle choir. Now, this Psalm 46 continues a series of psalms written by or for, probably by, the sons of Korah, starting in book 2 of the 5 books of Psalms. Psalm 42 started book 2, and that was by the sons of Korah, and so far all of the psalms have been written for the sons or by the sons of Korah. Now, Psalms 42 and 43 are probably the same psalm as they are in the Hebrew manuscripts. Psalm 43 does not have a heading, but if you hook it in with Psalm 42, Psalm 42 does have a heading of the sons of Korah. So we're going to assume that we're still looking at a different series of psalms now here in book 2. We start now in verse 1. The psalmist says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. That's a very famous psalm. People quote it all the time. Why? Because we're always in trouble. It never ends. God is our refuge and strength. Thank God for it. Verse 2, therefore we will not fear, though the earth should change, and though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea. Well, what does that mean? Even though the earth might change, I'm not going to fear. Well, here's some options as to the meaning. It could mean an actual earthquake. Though the earth changes in the sense that it shifts around as in an earthquake. Of course, change is sort of a milquetoast translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, though the earth trembles, and mountains slipping into the heart of the sea, that's what happens in earthquakes. So I think this is talking about, even though there's an earthquake, we don't need to fear. God's going to be with us. Now, that's easier said than done, my friends. I remember I was in Shanghai sitting in my living room reading a book, and all of a sudden the hanging light fixtures started swinging and everything started shaking, and I started feeling a little bit insecure, and I found out later there was a doggone earthquake and the whole 20 million people in Shanghai had left their homes and run out into the streets because they were told to. Of course, at the time I could not understand Chinese and I had heard nothing about it, so I just sat there in my living room reading my book. Thank God, boy, that concrete building would have collapsed like a house of cards if the earthquake had been a little bit closer inshore than it was. So I was very calm. I did not fear during that earthquake, but I didn't know about it. But if a believer experiences an earthquake, he is told here, don't fear. God's going to take care of you. Though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, and then verse 3, he talks about the sea. Though the sea's waters roar and foam, though the mountains quake at its swelling pride. In other words, when the waters smash up against the mountains, as the sea is raised from its normal level because of storm surges and such. Good poetic references here, because nature, when it gets upset, nature really gets to be pretty frightening. Though the mountains quake at its swelling pride, or the translations of quake at its swelling pride, KJV. Though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, the NIV. Though the mountains quake with their surging, with the seas surging. We get the idea. Now, I just interpreted that section, verses 1 through 3, very literally as a physical earthquake, but we need to remember that earthquakes and other natural phenomena are often used to portray social and political upheaval in the Bible, and I cannot emphasize this strongly enough. I'm going to give you a lot of quotations to try to prove that to you. Now, here's a quotation from one of my commentators. Which one it is, I don't know, because I forgot to write his name down, but this is what he says. Quote, biblical writers often used poetic language portraying political or social chaos as a shaking of the earth and seas. The image of a trembling earth and sky was also used to describe the final tumult of the day of the Lord. Now, this quote, I probably don't need to remind you, this quote shows how important it is when one studies eschatology to realize the metaphorical usages of earthquakes and other meteorological phenomena. Because when you read the book of Revelation, there's all kinds of stuff like that, and if you apply that literally, it gets to be pretty depressing. But if you apply it to the destruction of the Jewish polity in AD 70, which I do because I'm an Orthodox preterist, then you realize that when you see this so-called decreation rhetoric, you're talking about regime change. Let me read you another quote from John Gill. Quote, as to its position or fruitfulness, the earth's position or fruitfulness, or whatever changes, vicissitudes, and revolutions may be in the kingdoms, nations, and among the inhabitants of the earth, through wars and desolations made thereby. So Gill takes the earthquakes to be symbols of political revolutions and wars between nations. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, probably the earthquake referred to here means political commotions, such as those mentioned under the title, and by mountains, kings, or secular states may be intended. I don't know what Clark means about mentioned under the title. If he's talking about the heading, there's nothing in the heading that mentions earthquakes. But here's another quote from another commentator whose name I forgot to write down. So the destruction of kingdoms, empires, and cities is expressed by a like phrase. In other words, by a phrase that sounds like quake at its swelling pride, quake with the sea surging, the mountains are carried into the midst of the sea, the destruction of kingdoms, empires, and cities. Let's look at an example of Babylon in Jeremiah 51, verse 25. God says, behold, I am against you, O destroying mountain, who destroys the whole earth, declares the Lord, and I will stretch out my hand against you and roll you down from the crags, and I will make you a burnt-out mountain, a volcano, as Babylon is to be destroyed. Now, here's a quote from John Gill that applies verse 3 directly to the destruction of Jerusalem. Though the mountains quake at its swelling pride, the mountains quake, John Gill says, the passage may be applied to the destruction of Jerusalem and the wars preceding it and the dispersion of the Jews upon it. Well, many times that decoration rhetoric, earthquakes, stars falling from the sky, and so forth, yes, that does refer to the destruction of Jerusalem, but a lot of times it refers to the destruction of Babylon or destruction of Egypt or some other national entity. And so I don't think the psalmist here in Psalm 46 was thinking about AD 70 events. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, the secular rulers shake with the swelling thereof, tremble for fear that these popular tumults should terminate in the subversion of the state. So Clark takes the earthquakes as referring to political tumults. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, the most violent civil commotions are illustrated by the greatest physical commotions. Well, all of that is a lot of scholarly backing for the idea of this sort of decreation rhetoric. It's the type of language that's used in Revelation, which shows that Revelation might well be aimed at something other than an end-of-the-world cataclysm. I'm just trying to tease you to get you to look at Orthodox preterism, which is the correct view of the book of Revelation, in my humble opinion. We go now to Psalm 46, verses 4 through 6. The psalmist continues, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy dwelling places of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. This is Jerusalem will not be moved. The she refers to Jerusalem, the her. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations made an uproar. The kingdoms tottered. He raised his voice. The earth melted. Well, what river runs through the city of God? The city of God, of course, is Jerusalem. The holy dwelling places of the Most High, that of course is Jerusalem. The New American Standard has places in the plural, the holy places, which makes no sense to me. So if we take the Holman Christian Study Bible, we will see it's in the singular. There is a river, its streams delight the city of God, the holy dwelling place of the Most High. So, Jerusalem is called the holy place. Why? Because that's where the tabernacle is, and the tabernacle is where the Ark of the Covenant is, and that's where God lives, in the Ark of the Covenant, or maybe in the Holy of Holies. It just depends on how particular you want to be. Is he in the Ark, or is he in the Holy of Holies? The Shekinah glory was in the Holy of Holies a lot, and so is he in the tabernacle? You can refer to the whole tent, not just the Holy of Holies, or you can refer to the whole city. The point is that God lives there. So God lives in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the holy dwelling place. Holy means it's set apart from the world. It's not profane. and it's the place where the Most High lives. You can go high, but you can't get any higher than the Most High. So God is the highest of all the gods, the little g gods in the world. Now, what is this river whose streams make glad the city of God? Obviously, there's a river. The streams are branching out from the river, and it provides the water supply, if I can be so mundane here, provides the water supply of Jerusalem. John Gill suggests it's the brook Kidron, which ran through the valley to the east of the city. I think a better choice would be the waters of Siloam. The waters that ran from the Gihon Spring outside the walls ran through what is today, which later became Hezekiah's tunnel, then ran up into the city through the wall, and it ended up in the pool of Siloam at the southern tip of the city. And then, of course, that water was used to provide water for the city. And that makes sense to me. That's the river that the psalmist is probably referring to. But he uses that as a symbol of God's provision. He's going to take care of us. He's going to make us glad, just like that water makes glad when a thirsty Jerusalemite drinks it. Now, John Gill, who is always attuned to the prophetic significance of Old Testament passages, says that verse 4 is a prophetic reference to the gospel of Christ. There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God. Well, of course, the New Testament city of God, the New Jerusalem, is the church, and the streams that feed the church are the streams of the Holy Spirit. Here's a prophetic reference to that in Zechariah 14, verse 8, and in that day, meaning in the New Covenant era, and in that day living waters will flow out of Jerusalem. Half of them toward the Eastern Sea, that would be the Dead Sea, and the other half toward the Western Sea, that would be the Mediterranean Sea, will be in summer as well as in winter. And that is a prophetic reference to living waters. Out of your belly shall come living waters, as Jesus spoke about in the book of John. It all comes out of Jerusalem. The New Jerusalem, of course, is a symbol of the church. Now, I think that's very clear in Zechariah. I'm not so sure how clear it is in the Psalms. Revelation 22:1 says, "Then he," this is an angel, "showed John a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb." Adam Clark backs Gill up on this, and he says this river symbolizes, quote, "various peoples who should be converted to the faith and thus make glad the city of God." Now, God's favor in the scriptures is often denoted by a river. We read in Psalms 36, verse 8, the author of which is David, "They drink their fill of the abundance of your house, and you give them to drink of the river of your delights." The river of your delights. Zechariah 14, 8, "And in that day," I've just read that verse, I won't read it again. Zechariah 14, 8, "the living waters flowing out of Jerusalem, half toward the east, half toward the west." And likewise in Revelation 22, 1, "the river of life," which of course is symbolic of the gospel, the Holy Spirit providing salvation to those who drink of it. Now, one little rabbit trail here. Notice in verse 4 that Jerusalem is called the holy dwelling places of the Most High, the holy dwelling place. This shows that holy place doesn't always refer to that rectangular room in the tabernacle where the table of showbread was and where the seven-branched candlestick was and where the golden altar was. It shows that the city of Jerusalem can be called the holy place as well as that room in the tabernacle. Now, so what you say? Well, that has relevance for the study of eschatology. Now, God forbid that we would get off on an eschatological rabbit trail, but let's look at Matthew 24:15. "Therefore," Jesus tells his disciples, "therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place." And so many people have tried to say there's got to be something that happened in the holy place in the temple, some abomination. Well, what if it's this? When you see the Roman armies with their pagan standards, idolatrous standards, an abomination is closely associated with idolatry in the Old Testament, and it's an abomination which causes desolation. That's what armies do. They desolate places. When you see that, then flee to the hills, which is exactly what happened right before the destruction of the temple in AD 70 when Cestius, the Roman general, surrounded the city. He took his abomination, which causes desolation, his army, surrounded the city, and then he withdrew for reasons historians don't know why, and then the Christians fled the city just as Jesus told them to do when they saw the abomination of desolation. One more teaser. If you want to understand the book of Revelation and you haven't checked out Orthodox Preterism yet, please do so. You'll be pleasantly surprised. Now, verse 5, continuing with Psalms 46. In verse 5, the psalmist says, God is in the midst of her, in the midst of Jerusalem. She will not be moved. And of course, if Jerusalem is the place where believers dwell, well, we're not going to be moved either. God will help her when morning dawns. Why in the morning does God provide help? Well, in the morning is when attacks against cities usually were launched. That allowed an entire day for the battle to be decided, so attacking armies would always attack early. And so the point here in verse 5 is that God will provide help from the very beginning of trouble. When morning dawns, you're attacked. God's going to be there. God's help comes when we need it the most, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now in verse 6, the psalmist says, the nations made an uproar. Now it's impossible to say when this occurred, as the NIV Study Bible says, so we won't speculate. The kingdoms tottered. God raised his voice. The earth melted. Well, how does the earth melt? Well, of course, this is decreation rhetoric. Adam Clark says these words, the earth melted, seem to refer to thunder, lightning, and earthquake. The expressions, however, may be figurative and refer to the wars and desolations already mentioned. God gave the command, and one empire was cast down, and another was raised up. Regime change. Psalms 75:3, whose author was Asaph, the earth and all who dwell in it melt. It is I who have firmly set its pillars. So that's what people do. That's what mankind does with political entities. Constant war and constant fighting. I've just been inundated in medieval history, and that's all they do is fight over this, fight over that. Nothing is secure politically. I live in a country now where everybody politically is fighting all over the place. There's no peace. There is no security. The earth and all who dwell in it melt. They dissolve like a psychedelic vision of someone who is on LSD and watches the alarm clock and the lamp on his table melt and run over the edge of the end table. That's insecurity, folks. I've never done that, but I've heard people who have done it. And the person who was telling me the story was not telling it as something that he would like to do again. God has firmly set the pillars of the earth or the land. Could be referring to Israel. By the way, this whole thing might refer to Israel. The nations made an uproar that would refer to the tribes in Israel that are the Canaanite tribes who are attacking Israel. The kingdoms totter, that would refer to the Canaanite tribes. He raised his voice. The land melted, but it's probably earth. That's the way most people have it. We go now to Psalms 46, verses 7 through 11, and we will finish this audio. The psalmist continues, the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold, Selah. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has wrought desolations in the earth. He makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariots with fire. Cease striving and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold, Selah. First of all, let's note concerning these last five verses at what a positive ending to the psalm is. That's the way these psalms are all constructed. Trouble, grief, horrible stuff. But then at the end, God comes through. Verse 7, the psalmist says, the Lord of hosts is with us. What's a host? According to BibleStudyTools.com, host is an old English word for army. So when we see the Lord of hosts, we're talking about God's armies. And of course, God's armies would refer to his angels. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob. Jacob is another word for Israel, because the patriarch Jacob had two names, Jacob and Israel. The God of Jacob is our stronghold, Selah. Well, Selah is just a word that means pause. Nobody knows what it means. It's some kind of word that they just transliterate from the Hebrew. The translators do, because they don't know what it means. I just found out something interesting. The word Selah actually appears a couple of times in Habakkuk, the minor prophet. So we now see the psalmist is starting to employ military metaphors. The Lord of hosts, the Lord of an angelic army. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. There's a defensive fortification high up on a rocky crag. And then he's going to talk about offensive moves by God to protect Jerusalem, to protect the people of God. In verse 9, he says, he breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariots with fire. So military metaphor here. We go now to verse 8. The psalmist says, come, behold the works of the Lord. He's speaking to his friends, who, of course, are also believers in God. Behold the works of the Lord, and the works of the Lord is referring to military works, the destruction of God's enemies, the Lord who has wrought desolations in the earth, namely, desolation of the enemies of the people of God. He's whacked them. Now, of course, all that warfare that God is carrying out is in order to bring peace. Verse 9, he makes wars to cease to the end of the earth. So he wars against the evil people who are causing strife on the earth, and then he makes the wars to stop by beating those evil people. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. The enemy will no longer have an arrow to shoot at the people of God. The enemy will no longer have a spear to throw at the people of God. He burns the chariots with fire. The NIV has shields. He burns the shields with fire. The marginal note in the NIV has chariots. It's a translation issue. What is the point of burning chariots? Because it was usual to burn the arms of enemies defeated in war. Verse 10 says, "Cease striving and know that I am God." Now, the point of reference goes from the third person address to the friends of the psalmist. Now, the psalmist is speaking from God's point of view. Cease striving and know that I am God. Cease striving, that's the NASB. The KJV and the NIV have be still. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, stop your fighting. Well, what does this mean, cease striving or be still? Well, it could be addressed to all the nations of the world, an exhortation to stop making war, especially war against Jerusalem. And that's how the Holman Christian Study Bible has it, stop your fighting. But it could be that the psalmist is addressing his godly friends, and he's saying, be still. He's telling his friends to be quiet, to be easy, without fear, so they can hear the good news the psalmist is about to tell them, namely that God is going to be victorious in their behalf. Be still, friends. I got something good to tell you. Well, of those two options, I think it makes more sense to go with the Holman Christian Study Bible and say that God is speaking to the nations and saying, stop your warfare. I am going to be exalted, not you. I will be exalted in the earth. Now, I didn't mention this, but God who has wrought desolations in the earth, verse 8, that could be the land. Eretz could be translated land. I will be exalted in the land. That could refer to enemies of Israel rather than enemies against Jerusalem from outside of Israel. I think I lean toward earth in this case. Doesn't really matter. The idea is the same. Namely, in verse 11, that the Lord of hosts is with us. He mentions that phrase again, Lord of hosts, Lord of angel armies is with us. The God of Jacob, the God of Israel is our stronghold. Now in verse 10, when God says, I will be exalted among the nations, John Gill says, this is a prophetic declaration that the whole world will one day know God. And that is absolutely true. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Psalms 46. We are prepared now to go in our next audio to Psalms 47. Which I will entitle, God is King Over All the Earth. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.